You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Thank you for choosing our podcast. Our sponsors make it possible for us to keep bringing you new episodes. Please support them as they have some great deals just for you, our listeners. If you prefer to listen to ad-free content, simply find us on Patreon, where plans start from as little as $2 a month. 25% of these proceeds are donated to the DOE Network, working to bring closure to international cold cases. For more information, follow the link in the show notes. Our cases deal with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. Alaska, the land of rugged terrain, untamed wilderness, and icy winters, has a chilling history of brutal murders. This state, known as the Last Frontier, is shrouded in mystery and elusive beauty. But behind its stunning scenery lies a dark and sinister past that haunts local residents to this day. With a population of just over 700,000 people, Alaska may seem like a peaceful and quiet place. But appearances can be deceiving. Despite its serene facade, this state's murder rate ranks among the top 25 in the United States. It's no surprise that the vast and remote landscapes of Alaska make it a perfect haven for the most twisted and sadistic killers. In the 1970s and 80s, one man terrorized Anchorage with his gruesome crimes. He was the owner of a local bakery and a respected member of the community. But beneath his charming exterior lay a predator with a deep-seated thirst for blood. For years, he prowled the streets of Anchorage for victims whose bodies eventually ended up in the icy tundra of the Alaskan wilderness, leaving no trace as to his heinous crimes. This is the chilling story of the man who became one of the most notorious serial killers in American history. Known as the Butcher Baker, Robert Hansen was a man who evaded justice for years and shocked the world with the depth of his depravity. Robert Christian Hansen was born on February 15, 1939, in Estherville, Iowa. He was the eldest of two children to parents Christian and Edna Hansen. Christian was a Danish immigrant and Edna, American. Young Robert was a sickly child who suffered from asthma and a stutter, which made him the target for bullying at school. He spent his early childhood in the small Iowa town of Pocahontas, which at the time had a population of less than 2,000. Robert's father was a beloved figure in their small town as the owner of the only bakery in the area that made authentic European treats. As a young boy, Robert eagerly helped his father after school, dreaming of someday following in his footsteps. However, Christian's violent temper and abusive behavior towards his son left a lasting mark on Robert's childhood, straining their relationship. Robert's mother was equally strict and overbearing, frequently resorting to physical violence as punishment for even minor misbehaviors. The constant abuse at the hands of his parents left Robert feeling helpless and alone. Despite his challenging home life, Robert continued to work alongside his father at the bakery, learning the tricks of the trade. When an acne-riddled Robert entered high school, he struggled to make friends. Classmates made fun of his stutter, and he began isolating himself from his peers. He never received the attention he wanted from girls, and he blamed them for their disinterest. He began fantasizing about taking revenge on the girls who turned him down, a prelude to his future sadistic behavior. As a teenager, Robert often found himself in trouble. At 16, he was caught stealing a car and was sent to a juvenile detention center. It was there that he was diagnosed with a rare eye condition that made him legally blind in one eye. Despite the setback, he developed a fascination with hunting and fishing, which provided him a welcome escape from his troubled life. After high school, he joined the Army Reserve and served for several years before being honorably discharged. His first sexual experience was with a sex worker. This experience would stay with him for the rest of his life. He began to cultivate a normalcy around payment and sex, and developed a fascination with sex workers. When he came back to Iowa after his time with the Army Reserve, his troublemaking continued. He burned down the school bus barn at his high school as an act of revenge against the kids who made fun of him growing up. In reaction to their son's embarrassing and apprehensible behavior, the Hansons sold their bakery and opened a resort outside of town. It was there that Robert fell in love with one of the female guests. They got married in the summer of 1960, but that marriage wouldn't even last a year. In 1961, Robert was working as an assistant drill sergeant at the police academy in Pocahontas, Iowa, where he was arrested for burning down the school bus barn. Local authorities sentenced him to 3 years for arson, but he was released after only serving 20 months. His young bride did not want to be married to a felon and filed for divorce soon after his arrest. A few years later, in 1963, Robert met his second wife, Darla Henriksen. She was aware of his criminal past, but as a deeply religious person, she believed she could help him to reform. The couple would go on to have two children, a boy and a girl. Wanting to get away from his life in Pocahontas, Robert convinced his family to pack up everything and move to Alaska for a fresh start. Anchorage is the largest city in the state of Alaska and is known for its stunning natural beauty and rich cultural heritage. It's situated on the shores of the Cook Inlet and is surrounded by towering mountains and glaciers, making it a popular destination for outdoor enthusiasts and adventure seekers. The city is home to many parks and trails, including the Chugach State Park, the largest state park in the country. But Anchorage wasn't always a picture-perfect place to live. In the 1970s and 1980s, it was still a growing city, a place people went to have a fresh start. It was where people could reinvent themselves, start over, and leave their old lives behind. It also had a reputation for being a party town, filled with single men looking to have a good time in the late night hours. The oil boom brought hordes of workers into town. Those people, mostly men, sought entertainment. The red light district thrived, with topless bars, exotic dance clubs, and massage parlors that were on every corner. This part of town was a place where rules didn't really exist, where money and cocaine were endless and out in the open. It truly embodied the Wild West lifestyle of the open frontier. Anchorage, as a town, also had a tolerance for sex work unlike other states within the U.S. The Hansons settled into their new life in Anchorage, and working as a teacher, Darla supported the family. Robert pursued his passions for hunting and exploring the outdoors. He was an avid hunter with a rifle, and sometimes also used a bow and arrow, stalking deer, sheep, and wolves. To reach remote hunting grounds, he bought a small plane and got his pilot's license. Hansen's dark side emerged soon after arriving in Alaska, and he began to frequent strip clubs and engage in extramarital affairs. But soon, these affairs weren't enough to even keep him satisfied. In the early winter of 1971, Hansen spotted real estate secretary Susie Heppard walking home and thought that she'd given him a flirtatious look. That was enough reason for him to follow her home. He propositioned her. Susie declined and made it clear she was not interested in him, and he responded by pulling a pistol on her. He tried to take her with him, but fortunately, she managed to escape. A week before Christmas of the same year, Hansen met Patricia Patty Roberts, a sex worker, at the Nevada Tavern in Anchorage. He drove her to Kenai Lake and said that he'd kill her if she didn't go along with his commands. He then proceeded to tie her up and rape her. Fortunately for Patty, he did not kill her and took her back to Anchorage. She only reported the crime a week later. Susie and Patty were lucky to escape with their lives. Their reports ended in Hansen's 1972 arrest. He was charged with the abduction and attempted rape of two women. However, he only served a few months in jail. Meanwhile, his dutiful wife Darla kept the boat afloat at home, and despite the concerning charges against her husband, decided to stay with him. In 1977, Robert Hansen was arrested yet again, this time for stealing a chainsaw. He was sentenced to 5 years, but appealed his conviction and was released early. During his short time in prison, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and prescribed lithium to control his mood swings. He was never officially ordered to take his medication, and was released from prison after serving only 1 year. It was after his prison stint that Robert began cultivating a wholesome reputation in Anchorage, portraying himself as a humble, working family man. He opened a bakery following in his father's footsteps and soon became a well-known member of the Anchorage community. From the outside in, he was a friendly baker, a church-going family man who loved the Alaskan wilderness. Police did not receive any complaints about the new and improved Hansen for many years. In 1983, an Anchorage resident saw a young girl running down 6th Avenue, barefoot and handcuffed. She flagged down a driver who stopped to help her. The girl was a 17-year-old sex worker named Cindy Paulson. The driver took her to a nearby motel, and they called the police. Cindy told investigators that she had been kidnapped and raped by a man who took her to his family home. She described his basement in detail, wildlife trophies on the walls, a chain dangling from the roof which he handcuffed her to, and there was also a bearskin rug. Cindy agreed to show police where the man lived, in a family-friendly neighborhood. The house belonged to Robert Hansen and his wife, Darla. According to Cindy, Hansen had picked her up off the streets. They agreed that she would perform oral sex for $200. As soon as she was inside his car, he pulled a gun on her and drove to his house. At the time, his wife and children were away on vacation. Hansen forced Cindy down into the basement where he proceeded to rape her. Then he had a nap, leaving her cuffed to the chain. When he returned, he told her that they were going to take a plane ride to his cabin in the woods, and then he marched her back to his car at gunpoint. At the airport, Hansen prepared the plane for takeoff when Cindy seized the opportunity to sneak out and escape. She left her shoes behind as evidence and ran towards town on 6th Avenue, where she was picked up and taken to safety. Robert Hansen wasn't home when police arrived, so they waited. When he showed up, they told him about Cindy's story, and he vehemently denied picking up a girl the night before. He also had an alibi. He was at a friend's house repairing a seat from his airplane, from 5 p.m. till 11:30. Then he went to another friend's house where they ate pizza and talked about fishing till 5 a.m. Investigators were immediately struck by how extremely ordinary Hansen was. He seemed to be an honest business owner and a respectable family man, nothing more. In fact, they knew him as Bob the Baker, as they often stopped by his bakery for coffee and donuts. But when they searched his house, they found the basement Cindy had described, as well as the bearskin rug she mentioned in her statement. However, no physical evidence was found that would hold Hansen responsible for the crime. One of the officers refused to believe Hansen was guilty of the rape and attempted abduction, and thought Cindy had made up the elaborate story because she wanted more money out of Hansen. Besides, he had an alibi that checked out, and he certainly did not seem like a criminal. Hansen wasn't questioned further by police at this point, and no charges were laid. Another investigator, Greg Barker, however, felt Hansen was lying and decided to keep a close eye on him. Barker also looked into Hansen's past and discovered his criminal record, including his arrests for abduction and sexual assault in the early 70s. Barker began looking into missing persons cases, particularly those similar to Cindy, young and vulnerable girls who are often from out of town with no real connections in Anchorage. Barker was not the first investigator to suspect that there was more to the story. On July 17, 1980, the body of a female victim was found by electrical workers working in the area known as Aklutna. Based on her clothing and jewelry, investigators concluded the body belonged to a sex worker. There was no identification and no report of a missing girl that matched her description. Most of her skull was intact, so they were able to reconstruct her head, but they had some difficulty reconstructing the face so they could come up with a picture of what she might have looked like. They did, however, manage to construct an image of the young woman estimated to have been between 17 to 25 years old, who would eventually become known as Aklutna Annie. This case caused Maxine Farrell, a dedicated Anchorage police officer, to investigate other missing persons cases from the area in hopes that she might find a connection that would lead them to a perpetrator. In June 1982, a 24-year-old sex worker named Roxanne Eastland went missing as well. As time went on, there were one or two missing women every month, all of whom were sex workers or exotic dancers. But the police department didn't take these disappearances seriously at the time and didn't agree with Farrell that there was a potential serial killer at work. They chalked up the disappearances to the girls running out of town, or just going off the radar on their own accord. Farrell compiled a list of 10 girls who had gone missing in the area within a specified time frame, between the early 70s and early 80s. This list included Roxanne Eastland, Megan Emmerich, Lisa Futrell, Andre Fish Alterly, Sulana, Dylan Sugar Frey, Malay Larson, Teresa Watson, Angela Federn, and Tamara Tammy Peterson. But no one took any further action to investigate her findings. The names and pictures of these girls remained in folders and files, untouched and forgotten by the Anchorage Police Department. On September 12, 1982, off-duty police officer John Daly was enjoying some time off in the outdoors. He and a good friend of his were out moose hunting somewhere along the Kinnick River, 40 miles north of Anchorage, when they noticed a depression in the ground. They saw clothing protruding from the soil. Looking closer, they realized there was skin underneath the clothes, and they had stumbled upon a dead body. They called the state troopers and got a team out there to investigate the scene and look for clues as to who this person was and what might have happened to them. The body belonged to an unknown white female. An ace bandage had been wrapped around her head and eyes. She had one gunshot wound to the chest, right through the heart, and a .223 caliber shell casing was found by the body. A month after the discovery, the shooting victim was identified as 24-year-old Sherry Morrow, a dancer at the Wild Cherry Bar in downtown Anchorage. Sherry thought she was meeting a photographer and hoped a professional photo shoot could lead to better opportunities that could help her get out of the downtown club scene. According to her friend, she was excited about meeting the photographer. She was wearing blue jeans, a baby blue ski jacket, and silver-rimmed glasses. Sherry always had her lucky charm with her, a golden necklace with an arrowhead pendant. When her body was found, the necklace was missing, suggesting that the killer took it with him as a trophy. 24-year-old Joanna Messina was last seen in a bar in May 1980, and remnants of her body was found in a gravel pit by the Snow River. Wildlife had eviscerated most of her remains. Lisa Futrell's body was found in a gravel pit near Old Kinnick Bridge in 1984, 4 years after she was last seen in downtown Anchorage. On September 2, 1983, two hunters were out looking for moose when they found yet another shallow grave a mile downstream where Sherry Morrow's body was recovered. This victim was a young white woman with a bullet wound through her chest. A .223 shell casing was found near the body, suggesting that she was killed on the spot and that a killer made a feeble attempt at concealing her body. It was later found to be the body of Paula Golding, who was reported missing in April 1983, 5 months earlier. By this time, police could no longer deny the possibility that there may be a serial killer operating in the otherwise peaceful surroundings. Alaska State Trooper Sergeant Glenn Float became involved with the investigation as pressure mounted to find the killer. He contacted Maxine Farrell because she had a list of people who had gone missing and who fit the pattern of the victims being found buried in the Alaskan wilderness. A task force was formed, and a full-on murder investigation was underway. At this point, they discovered Cindy Polson's report and felt that her profile and her story matched all the missing women's stories on file. It was thanks to Cindy that police turned their investigation to the friendly neighborhood baker, Robert Hansen. Realizing the extent of Hansen's trouble, his friends who had provided an alibi for him on the night of Cindy's abduction came clean. They were covering for Hansen, thinking their pal Bob didn't want his wife, or anyone else in the community for that matter, to find out that he had picked up a girl from the street. Hansen was brought in for questioning and faced with all of his past allegations. At first, he claimed that he didn't shoot anybody and that they had the wrong guy. He was adamant about his innocence and assured them that this was all a misunderstanding. He admitted to having had affairs in the past and looking for oral sex from prostitutes downtown, but claimed that it never went further than that. One of the state troopers reminded Hansen that the girls who escaped from him, Cindy Paulson, Susie Heppard, and Patty Roberts, also said that they felt as though, if they didn't do exactly what he said, he would have killed them. Hansen insisted that he was telling the truth. However, he did ask for an attorney at the time. While Hansen was being questioned, police went to his house to search for evidence. His wife and children were home as police entered and searched every inch of the property. There was pressure to get Hansen off the street, so police were desperate to find some sort of physical evidence they could use against him. Maxine Farrell was called in to look for any jewelry belonging to any of the missing women from her records. After searching most of the house, they came up empty-handed, until one officer searched the attic. There, they found guns, ammunition, and a bag of jewelry belonging to the missing women. Among the items was Sherry Morrow's gold necklace with the arrowhead pendant. The case still wasn't airtight, though. Investigators needed to have more conclusive evidence linking him to the four murders. One of the most significant items found at the Hansen home during the search was an aviation map of the Anchorage wilderness. The map was marked with a number of X symbols, which led Sergeant Glenn Float to learn that those marks may indicate the grave sites of his victims. The biggest shock to police, however, was the number. There was a staggering 37 marks indicating potential dead bodies buried out in the woods. They arrested and charged Hansen with multiple counts of murder, rape, and kidnapping. He maintained his innocence, but faced with the evidence, he eventually confessed. In February of 1984, Assistant District Attorney Frank Rothschild recorded his interrogation of Hansen. During the session, Hansen said, "My main purpose, of course, behind the whole thing is to minimize in any way possible the hurt and so forth that this is going to bring upon my family." However, that seemingly decent gesture doesn't change the contents on the rest of the tapes. When asked point blank how many women he killed in Alaska, Hansen systemically went through what happened with each victim, starting with the woman found by the Eklutna power line, Eklutna Annie. He confessed to picking her up on the side of the road and offering her a ride home. According to Hansen, he drove out of town and the girl became suspicious, stating that she wanted to get out. He told her if she complied, she wouldn't get hurt. Then his pickup truck got stuck in a muddy swamp and they were forced to get out of their vehicle. The girl made a run for it, but he caught up with her, grabbed her by the hair, and dragged her to the ground. The cause of death was a knife wound to the back. Hansen later stated that she was his first victim. This would later be refuted, however. After confessing to the killing of the four women, the police had evidence against him. He told them that was it. Instead of folding and accepting with his confession, Rothschild showed him the aviation map with over 20 marks on it. "You're the only one who knows how many people you've killed." He then asked Hansen once again, "How many women, sir, have you killed in Alaska?" Hansen responded by looking at the map and saying, "There's a lot of marks here. I'm going to be honest with you. These marks represent something. That they do." Hansen told them stories about what happened to each of the victims represented by the marks on the map. He claimed to have dumped woman after woman in the river or various places in the woods. By the end of the session, Robert Hansen confessed to 17 murders. He accompanied investigators on a helicopter flight where he pointed out the grave sites that were corroborated with the marks on the map. The body of Sue Luna was found along the Knik River on April 24, 1984. Malay Larson's body was also found that same day in the parking area by Old Knik Bridge. The next day, Dalyn Frey's body was recovered in Horseshoe Lake. On April 26th, the bodies of Teresa Watson and Angela Federn were uncovered in Kenai Peninsula and Figure Eight Lake, respectively. Tammy Peterson was found almost 2 miles from Old Knik Bridge on April 29th. The last body that was found belonged to Lisa Futrell, who was buried just south of Old Knik Bridge. None of the other bodies were ever recovered. Hansen explained that his intention was to always return them back to their homes, but things always escalated, and he was left with no choice but to murder them. He placed the blame on the victims for not cooperating with his wishes. Through conversations with Hansen and hours of questioning, investigators were able to paint a picture of how his sordid mind worked. At first, he had affairs with women who did not work in the sex trade. He viewed them as decent women, therefore didn't try to take advantage of them. However, his close encounters with the police over the women he assaulted and attempted to abduct taught him a valuable lesson. He couldn't go around town targeting women with respectable jobs or husbands. He needed to choose his victims more carefully, and decided to target women who wouldn't be believed, women who held little value in society. This is why he set his sights on sex workers and topless dancers in the red light district. Part of his sick game involved the girl asking him for money in exchange for sex. In his mind, that made the girl indecent, which gave him permission to do whatever he wanted to her. His crimes typically followed a pattern. He would cruise the streets of Anchorage in his car, looking for women who fit his preferred victim profile, young, attractive, and often working in the sex industry. Once he identified a potential victim, he would offer them money for oral sex or a ride home. Instead, though, he would kidnap them and take them to a remote location in his plane. Hansen's preferred hunting grounds were the wooded areas around Anchorage. He would take his victims to his cabin, which was no more than a shack, really, located on the outskirts of the city. He often arranged dates with his victims, and they expected to meet up with a man who appeared to them to be nice and well-meaning. He didn't come across as aggressive or dangerous in the least. They felt safe with him, and were willing to take a risk going out on a date with him. He would tell them that he was a pilot and had a plane, and offered to take them on a romantic getaway to a remote cabin in the wilderness. But Robert Hansen was not interested in romantic getaways. He raped and tortured them before ultimately killing them. Hansen's method of murder was to bind his victims with rope, take them into the woods, and then set them loose so that he could hunt them down like animals. He would often use a Ruger Mini 14 rifle, which he would claim was a tool of his trade as a hunter. A friend from church revealed that he was invited on a hunting trip with Robert Hansen as a favor to Hansen's wife, who wanted Robert to be more involved with the church and have more friends. While out hunting, he recalled being uncomfortable with Robert. The baker didn't just seem to enjoy the process of hunting, but he really enjoyed the act of killing. This experience disturbed the friend, who had no idea the extent to which Robert Hansen enjoyed killing, not just animals, but human beings. During Hansen's trial, Frank Rothschild stated for the judge and jury, "Before you sits a monster, an extreme aberration of a human being, a man who walked among us for 17 years serving us donuts, danishes, and coffee with a pleasant smile. His family was a prop. He hid behind decency. This hunter who kept trophies on the wall now has trophies scattered across South Central Alaska, and while he doesn't talk about it or admit to it, it's obvious by looking at where things started and where women ended up, he hunted them down. He let them run a little bit, and he enjoyed the hunt. Just like with his big game animals." In 1984, he was sentenced to 461 years in prison without the possibility of parole for the murders of Sherry Morrow, Paula Golding, Aklutna Annie, and Joanna Messina, in addition to the kidnapping and rape of Cindy Paulson. It is important to note that Hansen confessed to killing 17 women, but only 12 bodies were found. His crimes went undetected for years, in part because many of his victims were transient or involved in the sex trade, and thus less likely to be reported missing. It wasn't until one victim, Cindy Paulson, managed to escape from Hansen's clutches that he was finally caught. In the years that followed his trial, more victims had been linked to Hansen, going as far back as December 1971. Celia Beth Van Zanten was 18 when she left her brother's house on Kinnick Avenue to go to the Bilo down the road one night. She never made it there and was reported missing. Her body was found 3 days later, on Christmas Day, at McHugh Creek State National Park. She had been tied up, sexually assaulted, and stabbed. When her abductor dumped her body in the ravine, she was still alive, and she succumbed to the elements. An X on Hansen's aviation map matched the location where Beth's body was found. Hansen denied murdering the 18-year-old, stating that he only killed women who worked in the sex trade. Megan Emmerich vanished from a dorm laundry at her boarding school in Seward in 1973 and has never been found. Hansen admitted to being in Seward on the day Megan went missing, but denied having any involvement in her disappearance. However, a former inmate claimed that Hansen confessed to him that he had killed Megan. He took her to a location reachable only by boat, killed her, then buried her there. Another inmate said Hansen told him that he had killed Mary Thill in 1975. 22-year-old Mary was last seen at a bakery in Seward, then at a waterfall. Again, Hansen was in Seward that same day. According to the inmate, Hansen said that he killed her in Resurrection Bay. On his map, there is an X that marked the spot. Although Hansen denied it, authorities believe he was the one responsible for Mary's demise. If these three victims were also killed by Hansen, who knows how many more there could be? And who is to say he only started killing in Alaska? Perhaps he left Iowa to escape his crimes. but because he didn't talk, we'll probably never know. Robert Hansen was first imprisoned at the United States Penitentiary, Lewisburg, in Pennsylvania. He returned to Alaska in 1988 and was briefly incarcerated in Juneau. In 2014, he was transported to the Anchorage Correctional Complex due to health reasons. Later that same year, Robert Hansen would die from natural causes. In October of 2021, the Alaska Bureau of Investigation, ABI, Cold Case Investigation Unit, CCIU, launched another attempt to identify the remains of one of his victims. For 37 years, one victim was only known as Horseshoe Harriet. In August of 2021, a new DNA profile for the victim was generated and uploaded into a public access genealogy database, and after more genealogical research was conducted, the victim was identified as possibly being a woman named Robin Pelkey. Records indicate that she had been living in Anchorage in the early 1980s when Hansen was active. She would have been 19 at the time of her murder, and there were no records of her being missing. The Alaska Bureau of Investigation is currently using genetic genealogy to identify Aklutna Annie, who was the last unidentified victim of Hansen's. Alaska appears to be a perfect place to commit a crime, with towns filled with transients, runaways, and societal castaways being surrounded by miles and miles of rugged wilderness. There's no telling what's out there, or the stories that the woods can tell. In the case of Robert Hansen, it was the perfect place to hide in plain sight, while conducting some of the most gruesome murders in Alaskan history, and tally up a substantial body count. He hid in plain sight, while serving donuts and coffee with the blood of countless victims on his hands. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit us on social media to see more about today's case. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also check out our channel on YouTube. If you like what we do here at Evidence Locker, subscribe in Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now, and kindly leave a 5-star review. This was the Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.